A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's writing in from a beach in Greece, mid-layover. Ezra's screaming his lungs out, and he's sitting with this tension that I think every parent knows but doesn't always articulate. He and Hannah don't have family in Israel. No grandparents to drop the kid with for a few hours. They're traveling back from visiting family in the US, so this is the opposite of a vacation. And he's caught between two things that are both true. He feels for the people trying to enjoy a quiet afternoon who didn't sign up for a screaming 14-month-old, and he also sees that parents who don't have support can either stay locked at home or be what he calls a social menace. His questions got layers. One, what kinds of experiences actually work for parents with young children? Has anyone built the beach for parents, the bar where kids belong? 2. Is the better answer for societies to just normalize that children are part of life and stop making parents feel ashamed for bringing them along? And underneath all of it, there's a guy who's exhausted and embarrassed and wondering if the shame is even his to carry.
The shame piece is the one I want to sit with first, because I think it's doing the most damage, and it's also the part where the structural answer and the emotional experience don't line up at all. I was a pediatrician in Jerusalem for a long time. I saw parents, mothers especially, apologize for their children existing in a waiting room for children.
The one place the kid is supposed to be.
Right, and the apology is automatic, it's reflexive, it comes out before anyone's even looked at them. That's not a personal failing. That's internalized from years of side-eye on buses, in cafes, on planes. Daniel says he's mortified but also too exhausted to feel embarrassed in the moment, and that split is real. The embarrassment catches up later because it's social. It's not about the kid, it's about the gaze of strangers.
He's describing something specific, though. It's not just public spaces broadly. It's spaces where the implicit contract is that people paid for quiet. A plane ticket, a beach resort, a nice restaurant. The other people there feel like they bought something, and the screaming baby is taking it from them.
And that's where the two questions collide. If you normalize children in public life, you're asking everyone to renegotiate that contract. But if you build parallel spaces, the family beach, the kid-friendly cafe, you're also sort of conceding that the default spaces aren't for families, and families should go over there.
Segregation with a smile.
Yeah. And I don't love that either, but I also think there's a practical reality here that Daniel's living in real time. A 14-month-old on a Greek beach during a layover isn't a situation where philosophical arguments about public space help anyone. The kid's tired, the parents are fried, and the people nearby didn't ask for it.
So walk me through what actually exists. What's been tried?
There's a whole spectrum. On one end, you've got the fully separate family infrastructure, resorts that market specifically to parents with young children, where the pool has a shallow waiting section, the restaurant opens at 5, and nobody blinks at a meltdown because every table has one. Some of these places are well designed. The Washington Post did a roundup a few years back of beaches that work for toddlers. Gentle slope into the water, shade structures, rinse-off stations, nearby bathrooms. The physical design matters enormously.
Gentle slope seems like the kind of thing you don't appreciate until you're holding a squirming kid in one arm and trying not to fall over on rocks.
And those design choices are cheap, honestly. It's not a massive capital investment to make a beach access path that works for strollers. It's a decision. But the resort model has a ceiling. It's expensive. It's not something you can access on a layover, and it doesn't solve the problem of everyday life.
Daniel's not looking for a vacation. He's looking for the ability to exist in the world without feeling like a menace.
So the next tier down is what some cities have started doing, which is designating family hours or family zones within existing public spaces. Libraries have done this forever, story time, kid sections, but it's spread to museums, some airports, a few transit systems. The idea is you carve out times or areas where the expectation is flipped. Children are assumed to be present and noisy, and if you want quiet, you go somewhere else.
because it doesn't require building anything new. It's a scheduling trick.
And it works surprisingly well when it's clearly communicated. The problem is it's usually a Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, which is useless for anyone who works.
Or for a family on a layover in Greece.
Right. Daniel's situation is acute. He's in transit, he's between countries, he's got no support network in either place at that moment. That's a specific failure mode of how we've designed travel infrastructure. Airports have figured out how to sell you duty-free whiskey and overpriced sandwiches, but the family with a melting-down toddler gets a bathroom floor to sit on.
Some airports have started putting in play areas. I've seen them.
They have, and they're better than nothing, but they're usually a carpeted corner with a plastic slide that hasn't been cleaned since the Obama administration. The good ones, Singapore, Changi, Schiphol, Helsinki, have actual family facilities. Nursing rooms, stroller rental, quiet zones, sometimes even sleeping pods you can book. But those are the exceptions, and they're concentrated in hub airports that had the budget and the political will to do it.
So the infrastructure exists in pockets, and the design principles are known. Why isn't it everywhere?
Because it doesn't generate revenue directly. An airport makes money from retail and parking. A play area takes up square footage that could be a duty-free shop. The calculation is brutal and short-term. Nobody's measuring whether families choose connecting flights through airports with good facilities, but they should be. There's probably a loyalty effect there that's real but invisible to the spreadsheet.
Daniel's other question, though, the normalization one, that's harder to engineer. You can build a play area. You can't legislate that strangers stop glaring at parents.
No, but you can shift norms, and norms do shift. Smoking on planes used to be normal. Now, if someone lit a cigarette in row 12, the entire cabin would rise up. That changed through a combination of policy and social pressure over about 20 years. The question is whether public tolerance for children is on a similar trajectory, and I'm not sure it is. I think it might be going the other direction.
Say more about that.
There's been a cultural drift toward treating adult spaces as sacred in a way they weren't a generation ago. Part of it's economic. If dinner for two costs $150, you feel entitled to a certain experience. Part of it's demographic. People are having fewer children, later, so the number of adults who spend zero time around kids before having their own has gone way up. And part of it's just the atomization of public life generally. We're worse at sharing space with anyone who isn't like us.
The price of dinner thing is real. If I've saved up for a nice meal and someone's kid is watching a tablet at full volume two tables over, I'm not my best self in that moment.
Nobody is. And I think it's dishonest to pretend that all kid noise is equivalent. A baby crying on a plane is one thing. The parents can't control it. The kid's in pain from the pressure change. Everyone gets it. A 5-year-old watching YouTube without headphones while the parents ignore, it's a different category. That's not about normalizing children in public, that's about parents opting out.
Daniel's very much in the first category. He's actively mortified. He's trying everything, and it's not working.
And that's where the lack of support network really bites. He mentions they don't have family in Israel. That's not just a logistical problem, it's an emotional one. When you have no one to hand the kid to, every public outing is a high-wire act with no net. There's no backup. If the kid melts down, you can't call someone to come get him. You either power through or you leave. And leaving often means forfeiting something you paid for or planned for or needed.
The nuclear family as the only unit of care is a pretty recent experiment, historically.
It is, and it's a brutal one. For most of human history, child rearing was distributed across extended family, neighbors, older siblings. The idea that two adults, or one, should handle everything alone, while also working, while also maintaining a social life, is completely ahistorical. Daniel's situation on that beach in Greece is a direct consequence of that structure. They're isolated by geography and by the modern expectation that parenting is a private activity conducted behind closed doors.
So when the kid screams on the beach, the judgment lands on them as individuals who failed to control their child, rather than on a situation that's structurally impossible.
And the judgment is asymmetrical in ways that are pretty well documented. Mothers get it worse than fathers. The Atlantic ran a piece a few years ago about this. The public shaming of parents, mothers especially, for children's behavior in public. The comments sections on any article about flying with babies are a cesspool. People describe infants as though they're deliberately malicious.
A 14-month-old doesn't have a strategy.
A 14-month-old has barely figured out that objects continue to exist when he can't see them. He's not running a psyop on the beachgoers of Greece.
Although, if he were, that would be impressive.
It'd be. But he's not. He's tired, he's off his schedule, he's in an unfamiliar place, and he doesn't have words for any of what he's feeling. Crying is the entire toolkit.
So we've got two parts here. Build the parallel infrastructure, the family beaches, the kid-friendly everything, or push for normalization. Which one actually helps Daniel on his next layover?
I think you need both, and I think they serve different time horizons. The infrastructure is the short-term fix. If every airport had a soundproofed family room with a changing table, a chair, and a door that closes, Daniel's layover goes from crisis to manageable. That's achievable. That's a design specification, not a cultural revolution.
And some airports do have those now. But it's patchy.
It's patchy, and it's not standardized. There's no rating system for family friendliness in public infrastructure. You can look up an airport's on-time performance or its restaurant reviews, but you can't easily find out whether it has a place to calm down a screaming toddler. That's a market failure. Parents would use that information if it existed.
The normalization side is slower, but I wonder if it's also partly about parents themselves refusing to apologize. Not in a confrontational way, but just not absorbing the shame that's being projected.
That's hard to do when you're exhausted. Daniel's right that in the moment, you're too overwhelmed to feel embarrassed. The problem is the aftermath, when you're replaying it and feeling like you ruined everyone's afternoon. That's where the internalized judgment does its work.
There's a middle ground, though. A parent who says, I see you're frustrated, I'm doing my best, this will pass. Not as a confrontation, just as a quiet acknowledgement. That can diffuse a lot of the tension, both for the parent and for the people around them.
I've seen that work in practice. When a parent acknowledges the situation to the people nearby, even with just eye contact and a grimace, the hostility often evaporates. What people hate isn't the noise. It's the sense that the parent doesn't care or doesn't notice or expects everyone else to absorb the disruption without any recognition.
The tablet at full volume parent.
Right. Daniel is the opposite of that parent. He's hyper-aware. He's writing us from the beach mid-crisis. The guy cares deeply. And I think that's actually part of what's hard for him. He cares, and he still can't fix it. And that feeling of helplessness compounds the embarrassment.
So what about the specific question? What experiences work? Are there models out there that get this right?
A few. The Nordic countries have a different baseline expectation about children in public. Kids are in restaurants, on transit, in cafes, and the social friction is lower. Not zero. Babies still cry, but the ambient judgment is less. Part of that's policy. Parental leave, subsidized childcare. But part of it's just a norm that children are part of the public, not an intrusion on it.
Hard to import a norm without the policies that support it.
Very hard. But there are smaller scale things that work. I've seen cafes that designate a family side and an adult side. Same space, different expectations, no walls. It works because it's explicit. Everyone knows what they're signing up for when they choose a side. Some movie theaters do baby-friendly screenings where the lights are up a little, the sound is down a little, and nobody shushes you. Those sell out.
The baby-friendly movie screening is such a simple idea. Same product, slightly tweaked parameters, completely different social contract.
And it's profitable. That's the part that should make this scalable. Parents are a market, they have money, they want to do things. If you build something that works for them, they'll show up. The failure isn't that the demand doesn't exist. It's that most businesses haven't bothered to think about it.
Daniel mentions a beach for parents with young children as something he's not sure exists. Does it?
Not as a dedicated thing, generally. There are beaches that are de facto family beaches because they're near playgrounds or have calm water, or are next to a parking lot so you don't have to hike in. But the idea of a beach designed from the ground up for families with babies and toddlers... shade, changing facilities, bottle warming stations, fenced shallow water, stroller-friendly access. I don't know of one that's purpose-built that way. It's a gap.
Seems like a beach town in Greece could clean up with that.
Market it as the family beach, make the amenities useful, and you'd have a loyal customer base that tells every other parent they know. The word of mouth among new parents is incredibly powerful because they're all desperate for anything that works.
The other thing Daniel's prompt made me think about is that the judgment flows both ways. He's judging himself. He's imagining what the other beachgoers are thinking. But he also says it's easy to judge without knowing what dynamics brought a family to that situation. That's a generous read, and I think it's accurate.
It is. You don't know if those parents have been up since 4 a.m. You don't know if the kid has an ear infection. You don't know if this is the first time they've left the house in a week. The default assumption when you see a struggling parent should be that they're doing their best with a hard situation, not that they're negligent or entitled.
And yet the default assumption is often the opposite.
Because it's easier. Judgment is low effort. Empathy requires imagining a whole context you can't see.
Daniel's doing both. He's judging himself and extending empathy to others in his position. That's a lot of cognitive load for a guy on a beach in Greece.
It is. And I want to say something about the long-term arc here because I think there's a risk of making this all about infrastructure and policy and missing the thing Daniel's actually experiencing. He's in a hard season. 14 months is a tough age for travel. It gets easier. Not because the world changes, but because the kid develops more capacity for regulation, more ability to communicate, more tolerance for disruption. The parents also get more skilled. They learn what works, what doesn't, what to pack, when to bail.
The first few trips are reconnaissance.
You're gathering intelligence. You learn that the aisle seat is better than the window because you can walk the baby up and down. You learn that boarding last is sometimes better than boarding first because it minimizes time on the plane. You learn that a new toy wrapped in foil buys you 10 minutes of fascinated silence. These are small things, but they add up.
And you learn which battles aren't worth fighting. Sometimes the kid watches the tablet. Sometimes you eat dinner at 4:30. Sometimes the beach trip lasts 20 minutes, and then you leave.
And that's fine. That's not failure. That's adaptation. The problem is when the shame prevents the adaptation. When parents feel like they can't go to the beach at all because they might have to leave after 20 minutes, and that would be embarrassing. Then the world shrinks, and the isolation gets worse, and the kid misses out on experiences too.
So the advice, if Daniel were asking for advice, is partly practical and partly philosophical. Practical, seek out the infrastructure where it exists. Use the tools. Learn the tricks. Lower the bar for what counts as success. Philosophical. The shame is real, but it's not yours. It's a social construct that's been internalized, and you can decide how much of it to carry.
And the third piece, which is maybe the hardest, build a support network however you can. Daniel says they don't have family in Israel. That's a fact. But networks can be built. Other parents, neighbors, a babysitter you trust enough for 2 hours. It's not the same as grandparents, but it's something. The isolation is what makes every outing feel life or death. If you have even one backup person, the stakes drop.
The babysitter for a few hours by the beach. That's what he said doesn't exist. And in the transient, layover context, he's right. You're not finding a stranger in Greece to watch your 14-month-old for an afternoon.
No, that's not realistic. But the layover is the extreme case. The everyday life in Jerusalem is the thing he can actually affect. Finding a regular sitter, building a parent network, creating the village that doesn't come pre-installed. That's slow work, but it pays off.
In the meantime, the screaming baby on the beach is just life. It's not a moral failing. It's a 14-month-old being a 14-month-old in a place that isn't optimized for him.
The beach has been around for millions of years. The idea that it's a quiet place for adults to read novels is very recent. Kids have been screaming on beaches for as long as there have been kids and beaches.
The seagulls don't mind.
The seagulls are probably grateful for the competition.
1989. I worked a summer at a beach concession in Rhode Island, Missquamicut. The owner had this idea. He sectioned off a strip of sand with rope and little orange flags and called it the family zone. Nothing fancy. Just a sign that said, families with small children here. And the interesting thing was, it wasn't just families who used it. Older couples would set up there too. People who wanted the noise, I guess, or didn't mind it.
The signaling was enough.
The signaling did all the work. Nobody complained because everyone knew what they were getting. The families didn't feel watched, and the people who wanted quiet went to the other end. Cost him about $40 in rope and flags.
That's exactly the dynamic I'm talking about. Explicit expectations change behavior more than any design feature.
The flags lasted one season. The town made him take them down. Something about beach zoning. He fought it for a bit and then let it go.
What was the objection?
They said it was exclusionary, which was backwards, but that was the argument.
Exclusionary to whom?
People who weren't families, I suppose. Never made sense to me. The whole beach was still there. He just put flags on 100 feet of it.
The town killed the thing that was working because of a principle that didn't apply.
That was my read. I was 19. I wasn't in the meetings. I just put the flags out and took them down.
Did anyone try it again somewhere else?
Not that I know of. I've looked. Every few years someone proposes it and it goes nowhere. The liability people get involved. What if a kid wanders out of the flagged area, who's responsible, and it dies?
The liability concern is real, though. If you designate a family zone, you're implicitly saying it's safer for kids, which means if something happens, you've created an expectation.
Sure, but kids wander into the water from the unflagged part, too. The rope doesn't change the physics. It just tells people where the kids are likely to be.
It's a coordination mechanism, not a safety device.
Right. Anyway, the thing I wanted to ask, this normalization idea you're talking about, if you did get it, if everyone just accepted that kids make noise and that's fine, would that actually solve Daniel's problem? Or would he still feel embarrassed because he's the kind of person who feels embarrassed?
That's actually the right question. Because some of this is internal, regardless of what the culture does.
Because I've been on flights with screaming babies, and I've seen parents who are completely unbothered. Not in a bad way. They're just not wired to care what strangers think. And then you've got Daniel, who's writing an essay from the beach about his moral obligations to the sunbathers. The culture could shift entirely, and he'd still be the guy writing the essay.
There's a personality component, absolutely. Some people feel the gaze more than others. Daniel's clearly on the high end of that spectrum.
Maybe the infrastructure helps everyone, but the shame piece only helps the people who were already inclined to feel it less. The Daniels of the world are still going to be mortified.
Unless the infrastructure gives them permission in a way that overrides the internal judgment. If you're in a designated family zone, and your kid screams, and everyone around you also has screaming kids, the embarrassment might actually fade because the context has changed.
Maybe. I don't know. I just remember the flagged beach, and the parents there still apologize sometimes. Habit, I guess.
Habit is hard to break. But I'd rather have a parent apologizing unnecessarily in a space that's built for them than apologizing on a plane where everyone's trapped and annoyed.
Fair enough. I've got to wrap this up. I'm supposed to be somewhere. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. If you've got a story about traveling with kids, or a beach that got it right, or a flag system that worked, we'd love to hear it. Email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.